Like the mythic warriors Canis, Cygnus, and Achilles, Athens acquired the boon of invulnerability. The long wall running from the citadel on the mountains to the sea linked the great city to its ports at Phalerum and Piraeus, ensuring its grain supplies and navy could endure even an endless siege. Among Athens' allies in the just-concluded war against Persia, the Spartans, the walls caused deep discomfort. The wealth and maritime power of Athens was growing dramatically, and the walls would hold back the ranks of Sparta's feared hoplite infantry. That meant the balance of power in the Aegean Sea was at risk. 2,500 years ago, so the historian Thucydides recorded, envoys from Sparta proposed to restore deterrence through mutual vulnerability. They argued for tearing down the walls of all the cities of Greece. The Athenian statesman Themistocles engaged Sparta in negotiations, but he was only stalling for time as Athens secretly completed the wall. Like so many which have followed it in the centuries since, the first arms control negotiations in recorded history collapsed amid suspicions and deceit, political scientist Carl Walling has written. The Athenians' own myths warned them that all three warriors finally fell. The stage had been set for a war which would tear apart the Aegean and end in the destruction of the city that hoped to become the sole superpower. Last week, the highly respected Stockholm International Peace Research Institute reported that the world's nation-states spent a staggering $2,440 billion. Billion, not million, on their militaries last year, the highest number in 6 decades. The biggest spenders by far were, unsurprisingly, the United States, which accounted for 37% of this spending, and China with 12%. But all 5 regions of the world showed significant increases, a sign of the deepening insecurity descending across the world. Even though the figure isn't as dramatic as it seems at first, at about 2.3% of global GDP, it hovers close to the norm of many nations for peacetime defense spending. It shows in stark relief that the sharp decline in arms races after the Cold War has been decisively reversed. And as historians have shown, where arms races begin, wars often follow. Leaders of the 3 superpowers, the United States, China, and Russia, could do worse than read the story of the tragic fall of Athens and consider its lessons. From his elegant chateau at La Brède, the aging aristocrat, philosopher, and judge Charles de Montesquieu bleakly recorded that, I quote, "A new disease has spread across Europe. It has smitten our rulers and makes them keep up an exorbitant number of troops." The disease has its paroxysms and necessarily becomes contagious, he wrote in his memoirs, which were published in 1748, as wars raged across Europe. For as soon as any one power increases its forces, the others immediately increase theirs, so that no one gains anything by it except common ruin. Archaeologists have since given us reason to suspect that the arms race is actually somewhat older than 18th century Europe. Evidence from skeletons found at Jebel Sahaba in Sudan established that some 13,000 years ago, 2 groups of our ancestors, one of them short and the other tall, used spears and arrows with transverse distal cutting edges to maim each other more effectively. The killing was indiscriminate, extending to women and small children. 5,000 years later, humans had learned to fight their battles with aerodynamically efficient sling stones, which were even mass-produced for wars in the southern Levant. European history through the medieval period, historians like Terence Wise demonstrate, can, among other things, be read as one colossal arms race, with fortifications designers seeking to outthink siege engineers, longbow manufacturers pitting themselves against armorers, and commanders inventing new mobile warfare tactics. France and Burgundy competed between 1465 and 1477 to produce the best mobile siege guns, while England and Spain vied in warship construction through much of the next century. The coming of the industrial age, though, created the tools for true arms races which we would recognize today. Large-scale production, organized scientific research, and nation-states with the resources to fund them. The competition for domination of Europe and new colonies across the world created the enabling circumstances for these 19th century arms races. France and Britain engaged in naval arms races in 1859-1860, Germany and Britain from 1898 to 1914, and others broke out across the world involving Russia, Japan, the United States and Italy. Even though governments also understood the competition was mutually damaging, historian David Stevenson has shown, efforts to contain it led nowhere. Tsar Nicholas II of Russia called the first Hague Peace Conference in 1899, hoping to head off an arms race in quick-firing field guns, but came away with nothing but some anodyne declaration. For a time, it seemed to leaders that military competition could be safely managed. The first shots of the First World War blew away that illusion. Those shots weren't, as pop history now has it, heard across the world. The assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand and his wife Duchess Sophie on the Latin Bridge in Sarajevo was barely noticed elsewhere in the world. British newspapers were focused on the conflict in Ireland. The United States had long retreated into isolation. France's papers were obsessed with what else but a sex scandal. Weeks later, jaunty marching bands were cheering on soldiers headed into a war that would end in the death of 10 million soldiers and 7 million civilians. Enabled by the arsenals they had amassed, Europe's great powers marched into the abyss, certain their huge weapon stocks would ensure a rapid conclusion to hostilities. Europe before the First World War was riding a great wave of prosperity that had stretched for over a century. Its markets were better integrated than ever before. And yet, poor political judgments led to carnage. Looking back at the hideous slaughter of 1914-1918, which claimed the flower of a generation, the moral seemed clear to British Foreign Secretary Edward Grey. The enormous growth of armaments in Europe, the sense of insecurity and fear caused by them, it was these that made war inevitable, he wrote. Great armaments, Grey ruminated in his memoirs, lead inevitably to war. If there are armaments on one side, there must be armaments on other sides. As historian Paul Kennedy has thoughtfully argued, arms races weren't themselves the problem. Each of these arms races was, rather, the result of failures of political decision-making to address insecurities and tensions. Leaders, Kennedy observed, needed to determine that the economic, social, and strategic costs of going to war were not worth bearing. But they were rarely able to do so. Following the First World War, though, an elaborate system of arms control was put in place. But leaders in London and Washington failed to respond to its violation by Nazi Germany, misunderstanding the strategic threat posed by Adolf Hitler. Seeking to avoid the risk of again being surprised by their adversaries, both the superpowers, the United States and Russia, stockpiled nuclear and conventional weapons through the course of the Cold War. Even hawks like President Ronald Reagan, though, realized that the expansion of arsenals eventually led both sides to a dead end. The end of the Cold War seemed to promise an end to the arms races that had sapped resources worldwide. Through the rearview mirror, though, it's obvious that's not how events unfolded. The political scientist Joseph Nye, in a prescient essay published in 1989, when most people were going on about how the end of war was nigh, noted the bipolar world was giving way to a more amorphous order, in which great powers are, I quote, less able to use traditional power resources to achieve their purposes because private actors and smaller states have become more important in many issues. even as the United States sought to establish itself as the sole global hegemon before encountering some painful lessons in Afghanistan and Iraq, its actions sparked deep concerns among its competitors like Russia and China, as well as smaller states. The war in Ukraine, as well as the growing tensions in the Taiwan Straits, are fueling new competition among the three superpowers. Elsewhere, the growing anarchy in the global order is leading regional powers and smaller nations to arm themselves too, fearing threats from their neighbors or from internal dissidents. Likely, preventing a war between major powers will require them to engage in meaningful political dialogue on the limits of their ambition. Expansionist territorial claims of the kind Russia is pursuing in Ukraine or China will need to end. The United States, in turn, will have to accept that its competitors have legitimate security interests in their periphery. They need to act like sated powers, Walling pithily observes, as Athens should have been, not what it was. There is an overwhelming good reason for the great powers to avoid skipping towards war, and the opportunity still for them to do so. The time available, though, is not infinite. I'm Praveen Swamy, and I'm a contributing editor at The Print. Thank you for listening to this week's Security Code.